I'm flinging myself into spring cleaning.
I'm going to fling into spring at Total Wine and clean up on Chardonnays and fruit-flavored vodkas at low prices.
Wondrous selection, helpful guides, always low prices. Total Wine and more.
Hey everyone, this is Christian Heimel, host of Caught Listening. Thanks for listening to the following podcast on Public House Media.
Disarming disability.
Oh, hello. We're so excited that you made it back for yet again another amazing episode of Disarming Disability. We cannot wait to share with you the guests that we have today and to deep dive into conversation. Although, before we do, well, I guess I should say, hey, what's up? I'm Nicole Kelly, and...
Hey, I'm Sarah Tuberty.
But I almost skipped our intros because I was so excited for Sarah to tell us about what's going on in her world. Sarah, what are you surrounded by right now?
Okay, so I am surrounded by, I kid you not, a million fruit flies. I just came back to Philadelphia. I've been in Arizona for almost 2 months hanging out with my parents. Also, welcome humidity. Oh my gosh. I forgot about that. I walked off the airplane and was like, whoa. So I'm trying to remember how to live in the humidity lifestyle again. And then I came back up to my room to this really delightful party of fruit flies. So as you know, I love houseplants and I have a million houseplants. And during the time that I was gone, the fruit flies felt that they needed to take this space and just sort of hang out and multiply. So I then learned that fruit flies will lay their eggs in like moist soil. So now I am surrounded by fly strips and I have some like fermented fruit in a cup to try to trap them. And then I also looked up on the internet about that you can buy aquarium rocks and put them on top of the pots to try to help prevent the larvae from coming out. It's just so, that's where I'm at. It's been a delightful surprise. They're all my friends now, I suppose. I don't know. But so yes, that's what how are you doing? What are you surrounded by?
Man, nothing that exciting. I just spent my weekend. I actually did a deep clean of the apartment, which again, I feel like this makes me so old, but I can't help it. It makes me feel so good to just like have my space clean and to have all the laundry done and to have like vacuumed and mopped the floor and just to like really reset, you know, really be in control of your space and just to like kind of refresh and renew. But also I should mention that as part of my refresh and renew, I wandered to Walgreens and there's a handful of things. I live two blocks from Walgreens. In there that I needed to get while I was cleaning, right? Like cleaning products. And while I was there, I was like, I definitely need a new candle because I'm cleaning and I need a new scent. But I had not planned on getting many things. So I didn't have any kind of cart or basket with me. So I just had like piled things up in my arms. So I'm wandering around balancing like 12 things in my one hand, which you know where this story is going.
Yep.
Know where it's going, probably because you've been there before, so you probably understand. You understand. So I'm doing so well. I've like totally piled everything up. The candle's on top where I can like keep an eye on it. And yes, it's in glass. And yes, it's, but like I'm keeping an eye on it. It's good. And I make it to the register because I'm ready to finally check out with all of my goods. And like in slow motion, the glass candle falls to the ground and shatters absolutely everywhere. And I'm just so disappointed because in that moment, here's some like one-handed truth knowledge that I'm about to drop. There is no way when you are in that situation to make the clerk who's like about to check out the stuff, like there's no way it's not going to be awkward because they are immediately going to be like, oh, shit, that girl has one hand and oh, shit, she dropped that candle because she has one hand, which is totally truth. That's like,
I didn't help her and yeah.
Yeah. And so I just was like, oh, I just really did a fail for the one-handed world. But luckily she was really nice. And, you know, I cleaned up the big pieces of glass, but, you know, they quickly came and swept it up, and it was no big deal. And it was a passing moment, and the world moved on, and it was okay. But, you know, I had to move on without the new candle, which is sad. It smelled like birthday cake, which was really good.
Okay. We can get another birthday cake candle.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of birthdays, that makes me think of the day that I was born, in that I was born without, you know, I was missing fingers on my left hand. And again, like, really trying to work on that terminology. I don't totally love missing, but I don't feel like there's another word to better describe stuff. I was born with I'm a congenital hand amputee. Very shortly after being born, my parents were connected to Shriners Hospital of Northern California, which is where I grew up at, you know, in the Northern California area. And my parents were linked up with Dr. Michelle James, who is now the chief of pediatric orthopedics surgery at the Shriners Hospital of Northern California. They found Dr. Michelle James when I was about 6 months old, and then became really connected with her. And I'm so excited to share that she's going to be our speaker for today. And that she's been part. So exciting. And
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I just am like so stoked for this connection and the fact that Dr. James has literally been with you since you were 6 months old and had a relationship with you for that long, and that she's so excited to be our expert. I'm sorry, I'll stop talking. Please go on.
That's it. And it's just been like such an important part of our family for so long. And you know, I would go into Shriners every couple of years as part of a couple follow-up studies. So they would just sort of see what my functional development was, like, you know, as far as recommendations for surgeries or just like how I'm doing, you know, in sort of comparison to kids that are, you know, are older, and to be able to use them as role models for the kids that are younger. I mean, for years, I've been helping to serve like parent connections. And then Dr. James so graciously allowed me to come in to when I was in college and really trying to explore what type of my trajectory was and what I wanted to study. She let me come in and helped hook me up with a really awesome volunteer position. I got to observe tons of surgeries that she did and hand surgeries. And just like, how cool is it to watch somebody who did a surgery on me and then like watch her do surgeries on another kid? Like, it was very meta. It was so cool. And just like so honored to be invited into that space and know that that's such a treat. And then So I've been a part of Shriners and a part of, you know, sort of the hand team in that way. And then this past summer, I did my doctorate project on creating a parent resource. It was like an online parent resource page. And so Dr. James was my mentor, and that we worked very closely together as far as like how to best provide supports for parents, because so much of that is like, oh my gosh, what happened? What do we do? How do we support our kids? And so these were just sort of targeted strategies, just everything that we know just initially so they can look at it here. And then that can help guide their conversations as far as what they want to do, if they want to see treatment, what treatment looks like, all that kind of stuff. I've been over to her house for dinner. She's invited me there. Her daughter gave me a tattoo. Like, I'm so excited and just like, am so just thankful for the roles that she's had in my life and such, gave me such positive impact, and really encouraged me and pushed me to really pursue all of this work. And has really like put me in those spaces. So I'm just so thankful and so excited. And she's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, let's totally, let's get to it. Let's get to the interview with Dr. James so everybody can meet her and just know how big of a badass she totally is.
Seriously.
Dr. Michelle James is a pediatric hand surgeon. She serves as the chief of orthopedic surgery at Shriners Hospital for Children in Northern California, located in Sacramento. She's the Division Chief of Pediatric Orthopedics at UC Davis Medical Center and the Professor of Clinical Orthopedic Surgery at UC Davis and UCSF Medical Schools. Dr. James cares for children with hand malformations, post-traumatic differences, including burns and neuromuscular conditions, things like brachial plexus injury, spinal cord injury, and cerebral palsy. She focuses on the child's function and performance, especially from their own perspective. Her greatest professional joy is learning from a child or a parent that an intervention has improved her ability to accomplish a task that is important to them. From a personal perspective, Michelle has met her wonderful husband in high school. They've been married for a very long time and have two adult daughters. We're really excited to welcome Dr. James.
Hello and welcome, Dr. Suji. We're really excited to have you on today's podcast. And this is really exciting just for me personally because Dr. James has been my hand surgeon and I've known her my whole life, which then looking sort of back on your bio has sort of been your career as well. So I'm excited to sort of talk about that and bring on and welcome you. So I just really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be able to share with us your wealth of knowledge that you have.
Well, it's completely my pleasure. It's really a pleasure to speak with both of you.
Totally. I'm gonna hop in here, Dr. James. This is Nicole. And what can we just, you know, as long and wonderful as your career can be, can you give us a little snippet of what that has been? Can you tell us how you became involved in children's hand surgery? And what has been kind of your journey into where you are now?
Well, it was sort of iterative. I first decided to be an orthopedic surgeon when I was in medical school, and that was not a very typical decision at that time for a woman. We still are only about 9% of my profession, and then it was less, but I had some really amazing role models, including one of the first women in orthopedic surgery when I was training, and that had a huge impact on me. And I was attracted just to the partnership and problem-solving nature of the specialty, where you sit down with someone and address what's important to them. And that just was very satisfying to me. It's also very hands-on. There's a lot of variety. And in most of my specialty, you end up seeing people of all ages. I narrowed down to kids after a couple of years in private practice. I fell in love with hand surgery when I was an orthopedic resident just because of the nature of it. Is the anatomy is just fascinating and complex and directly related to function. And then when I started my practice, I was volunteering at a children's hospital and found that was the favorite part of my week, and ended up moving there full-time, actually right around the time Sarah was born, as a matter of fact, because I was pregnant with my daughter, who's the same age as Sarah, when I made the change. And it was I just never looked back. I just completely fell in love with working with kids and families and just the whole sort of wraparound idea of looking at the whole person and figuring out how to help their hands work. So
I have I have distinct memories sort of following up on you working with kids. I remember coming in and shadowing when I was in that high school, early college aspect, and you're sort of working with toddlers and pulling out different stickers so that you could see what their, like, rotations of their hands were. So you'd stick, you know, like a sticker on the back of their arm to look at their supination or pronation and their ability to rotate their arms around. And it's sort of fun because the child's thinking they're playing with stickers, but you're using that as a method to really assess function because toddlers aren't really great at following directions and, you know, moving hands specific ways. So I just think that that's a really fun space that you can sort of work with children with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, most of the time, I can't believe I get paid for what I do. I mean, we have a whole clinic where we get down on the floor and play with babies, you know, when they have a certain type of birth injury, so we can figure out how they're using their arm and hands. And just handing a tape measure, you know, the kind where you pull out and then push the button and it retracts, just handing that to a kid, I've been doing it for, I don't know, 30 years, and I still see kids do different things with tape measures than I've ever seen before. So, and, you know, it doesn't matter how many fingers or hands they have. They'll use whatever they have to work with to make the tape measure work. And it's entertaining and fun, and it's really cool for the parents to see. You know, I love watching the kids through the parent's eyes too, and watching them realize, hey, she's going to be fine. You know, she's doing everything I could have hoped.
Well, I was just going to say how interesting that you bring that up. Sarah and I talk a lot about kind of in our own worlds and in our own lives how the child's experience and perspective is so different than the parent's journey and perspective. Can you talk to us a little bit about
the changes that you see in parents, the parents who, you know, bring you a newborn baby, and then as you care for them, you know, and then have a 30-year-old Sarah, you know, in front of you who you worked on. What does that parent journey kind of look like as you are touching base with them and seeing these kids grow?
That's a really perceptive question, because that's one of my favorite things to do. And I've started, thanks to Sarah's work at our hospital last summer on a website that we put together, which I refer people to every day, I've started doing sort of better defined, what do they call it in pediatrics, anticipatory guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Because the parent journey, I mean, everybody's different, but most typically, I love to see kids when they're newborns. I love to see them as, you know, as early as possible. Maybe not prenatally. Prenatal is tough because all the parents know about the baby is that they have a hand difference and they haven't seen, you know, that she looks just like grandma, or, you know, they don't know anything else about her yet. So that makes it, that's kind of a hard conversation. But once the baby's born, you know, I see parents who are worried, or they underestimate the child's abilities. They worry that they're going to be teased. You know, they worry that no one will want to hold their hand. I mean, they go through, all of that's running through their head, kind of whether they tell you or not. Mm-hmm. And usually I feel like if they trust me enough, they're going to start crying, because they're feeling, you know, they're feeling grief, they're feeling sorrow. The baby looks different than they expected or that they knew. You know, they didn't know that hand differences were even a thing. And, you know, so we kind of talk through that, and I try to give them some little hints of, like, you know, you're going to come back here in 6 months and tell me you have the most wonderful child in the world who's doing everything you could have ever hoped. And then in 2 years, they're going to be driving you crazy. And, in 5 years this, and in 8 years that. And so I kind of go through the stages that Sarah really helped me understand and define. So I use the guide of the website that she put together to kind of map it out for parents. And I don't drag them through the whole childhood, you know, but I just kind of try and talk about highlights. And that early visit, I think, just kind of establishes a bond between us. And then the next time they come back, you know, they're happy to see me, because I told them, your kid's going to be fine and they're going to surprise you and do everything you could hope. And then they come and tell me that. And it's very, very satisfying. It really is. And just the part about my job that I think I love the most is the building the relationships and talking to people over time and watching kids grow up, is just really rewarding.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's fun. They don't all turn out quite like Sarah, but.
Yeah, this is funny. Can you share with us sort of what are different things you can offer for families? And in saying that, like building that rapport, and then, you know, you sort of have different kids and families will come in for various follow-up visits. At what point do you sort of discuss surgical interventions? Is surgery always an answer? Like, what does like, do you just have kids that sort of follow up periodically over time? You know, like, they sort of on a schedule, like they come in every couple of years? Or do they just sort of come in when they need something? What does that sort of look like when you're offering sort of your role in their care at Shriners?
Well, it can look different depending on the condition. But the general idea is to respond to the needs of the child and family. And sometimes that's reassurance. Sometimes we end up not ever providing surgery or a device or a splint or a prosthesis. We just check in on them. And early on, the visits are more frequent because the kid's changing, you know, mm-hmm. more rapidly. So, I mean, I don't personally have concerns about the development of a child with a unilateral hand difference, with a hand difference on one side. I know mm-hmm. that they're going to develop just fine. But parents have concerns. So, you know, just following up and checking on them They feel, sometimes people will feel better if we're checking on them. And also I can do the anticipatory guidance. Okay, when she's five, you're likely to run into this. When she's eight, this, and so on. When we talk about surgery, most of the surgery that I do, the vast majority of it is elective. And that means that it's shared decision-making between me and the parents when the child is younger and between me and the child when they're older. And there's pretty good evidence that most kids are able to make a stable decision about things like surgery, as long as you can take fear out of it, you know, as long as they're not afraid of pain, they can make a pretty stable decision by about age nine. It just seems, you know, they look at things the same way as adults do in terms of weighing things. They're pretty concrete still, but as long as you can make the information fairly basic and concrete, you know, most nine-year-olds can make a stable decision. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. I remember, I had two surgeries from you, right, Dr. James? The first one, I was a year and a half, 13 months old, so I don't remember that one. But I do have pictures of casts of my hands and feet, and they're all decorated, which is fun. But I do remember, and probably the earliest memories that I have are of the surgery that happened when I was five, where we did the web deepening to sort of separate out a thumb for me to be able to engage in pinching. And I remember talking to you about that. I remember talking to my parents about that. I remember the dream that I had in the operating room. I remember waking up after the operating room. Yes, like it's just such a vivid memory. But I remember how cool it was and that I was very excited to be able to pinch onto stuff with my left hand. And we were talking about being able to grab markers, being able to grab pencils and things like that with my left hand. And I remember being really excited about that. I remember like understanding what was happening. And then I remember being really excited once the cast was removed and I actually got to start using it. And I remember doing like a presentation to my kindergarten class about what my surgery was. which is just so funny how vivid all of those memories are. But I remember that being a decision that we all made together and being really thankful for it. It's improved the function of my left hand pretty significantly in my own personal life. So I'm thankful that I was a part of that decision. So thank you.
Yes. Well, you were a little younger than most kids who would be able to make a stable decision. But, I think, and the operation we did on you when you were an infant is actually something, as you and I've talked about, that's something we no longer do because it doesn't work as well as we thought it did. And that's something that, you know, I mean, that you know how I feel about that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that once you've done an operation on someone that doesn't work, it's a really, really sad feeling. I mean, I really don't feel good about that. You turned out fine, but
just to recap what that surgery was, it was a toe transplant surgery. So I, Dr. James, and I believe your father has worked on that surgery as well. Is that correct?
He may have helped me with yours, but I don't think that he had any other connection with that. Yeah.
Okay. But
we got to work together for a long time.
Yeah, I want to say both of you did that operation, he worked with you worked with him on that operation. They took, you both took bones from my toes. So I'm I should know their actual names, but my third and second toe on my left foot and my middle toe on my right foot, and used those bones to transplant into the top of my nubs, because I have little nubs sort of at the end of my palm, to help, in theory, that it would have helped extend those nubs a little bit longer to help improve, you know, function. Because you can, you know, toes have a little bit of length to them, so if they were to grow, but that's the sort of theory behind that surgery, and it didn't grow as expected. And then I sort of have small toes as a result of that, just to sort of explain what that surgery was. And it's interesting. And then that's what a surgery that my father wrote a letter about while they made that decision. Because again, I was a year old, and I believe that it was most effective, were when it's sort of at that time period. So he wrote me a letter while we were in the operating room, just saying, this is why we made this decision. This is everything that we know. And like, please forgive us if this isn't something that you want when you're older, because we didn't have the opportunity to ask you. So my family was all of us, you and my parents. And this is something that we talked a lot about and has been a large part of my narrative growing up. And I really appreciate that level of communication.
Yeah, I have really good memories of talking with your family.
This is all
So again, this is Nicole jumping in here, and this is so it's totally an honor to hear you guys talk about this and kind of talk about personally what it means and you know, things that maybe were hopeful that would work that didn't work. Of course, you would think that over, you know, a 30-year career that things would change and that there would be things that I'm going to say that you grow out of or that the findings aren't exactly what you want. But again, the thing that I'm very struck by in what both you have been saying, Dr. James, and you, Sarah, is just the conversation of how it's not just, you know, a patient who you are looking to provide a surgery where there will become function. It also is partly emotional, and it also involves that third party of the parents. And so that's very interesting for me to hear, because in my brain, surgery is either practical or it's not. It either gives function or it doesn't. But also there are so many other factors to consider, and it's so interesting to kind of listen to how that gets to be a part of it. And the decision making that gets to go along with that. Yes, that's more a comment. I don't have a question. I think that's what I took away from listening to you.
Well, you made me think of, I mean, I remember when I became a parent. So I went from, I had my older daughter in the first, about when I was about 2 years into practice. But before that, you know, I was patient with parents, I thought, but in retrospect, I think somewhat condescending, you know, like people get crazy when they're talking about their kid. I mean, behavior can be really crazy when your kid is, you know, when your kid is the topic of a discussion. As soon as I had a baby, I had like a complete conversion to the point where preoperatively I'd be talking to a family and they'd start crying and I'd start crying. I thought, this is not helpful to them if their surgeon is crying while they're crying. But it really changed my focus to, you know, to understand, okay, I'm talking about somebody's kid here. This is, you know, and that stuck with me for my whole career. You know, we're talking about somebody's kid. When we're talking about doing surgery on a kid, we're talking about, you know, somebody's kid, which is the most important person in the world to them. And, you know, that helps. And it, actually, where I work, that is, it's a universal feeling. It's the culture. And that just makes it makes our job seem very, honorable, and, you know, we feel privileged to be able to have that that kind of an opportunity.
I'm wondering, I know that you have done a ton of research, and you've written and published a lot. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about maybe some hand-specific research that you've done. What has that looked like? What have you found? What's been interesting from the research aspect and point of view?
Probably the most interesting research project I did was about 15 years ago on kids who were born with one hand. So below elbow deficiency is what we call it, although Sarah's taught
me
to call it a different, and that's
Mickey,
right?
Yes.
And so we did a large study of 400 and almost 500 kids with that condition at about 11 hospitals. And we had them, we started out saying, you know, why don't these kids always wear their prostheses? Some of them do, some of them don't. Is it the type of prosthesis? Is it the training? Is it, you know, what is it? Why aren't they wearing them? Is it their parents' personality? I mean, we had all kinds of questions about this. So we tested that, and we tested kids with their prosthesis on and off if they had chosen to wear, and then kids who had chosen not to wear, we just tested without a prosthesis. And we found that for the daily activities that we were testing, the prosthesis didn't help. In fact, it seemed to actually get in the way for daily activities. We later found in a less scientific way that prostheses for kids with one hand can be helpful for other activities that, you know, require, that are designed to have two hands, archery or, you know, not really riding a bike, but some kids need them for a bike. I mean, various things that we now can make them as a tool, but the prostheses did not work and look like a hand for most kids. And so we ended up with a totally different finding that we started with. It was not a popular thing to present or publish because it wasn't kind of what anybody really wanted to hear. And, you know, it was a, I think it was probably the most impactful project I've done, but it was not satisfying.
It's, well, and that's so strangely affirming for me as a child who, of course, was put in prosthesis all growing up, and who was a child who never wanted to wear them, to kind of hear and to understand that yes, the people who were in charge of crafting and creating that were doing the research and trying to figure out why and what was going on and how to make it into a tool that would be useful.
That's fantastic. So switching gears a little bit as we're sort of ending, we'll sort of wind down because I know we're all busy and we all have things to work on, so we're going to be respectful of your time. Do you have any sort of like parting wisdom or things that you would like other people to know, both like parents and children and other healthcare professionals, sort of as reflecting in being so prominent in your career in being a pediatric hand surgeon?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think I would say that the single biggest joy of my career has been being privileged to take care of kids from when they are small until they grow up, and watching them grow up and interacting with families as they grow up. And then about 10 years ago, I saw my first next generation by surprise, where I was doing surgery on a little baby, and I went out to tell the parents that everything was going well and realized that I already knew the father because I had done his surgery when he was a baby, and I hadn't even realized that beforehand. And I think that just, I mean, when someone comes to me with their child and I was their surgeon, that's really, really wonderful and an honor. And I guess probably my main take home is, and I learned a lot of this from you, Sarah, and that is that, you know, I feel totally comfortable saying with authority to people now, your kid's going to be fine. You know, mm-hmm. they're going to be fine. You just, I mean, you're going to worry because you're a parent, but, you know, your kid's going to be fine.
Yeah. And it's true. We're all gonna be fine. And yes, we're all gonna be fine. There's different things that come up, but largely, and I think that's too. I just remember again shadowing you over the various years that I've had the fortune to be able to come into Shriners, and really hearing a lot of parent questions and concerns. And again, like they don't feel that they could ask these to their community because they don't see anybody else in their lives that necessarily have hand differences, and there is all sort of that like worry and guilt, and will my kid be able to do this, and will my kid be able to do that, and blah blah blah. And I remember there was one boy that we went in and saw, and he was younger, maybe six, and his parents were just like, you know, how are you gonna play football and blah blah blah, and like, will people notice? And I've been standing there the whole time. I wasn't hiding my hands, and I think I felt encouraged to say something like, well, this is what my hand looks like. And they were just like, oh my gosh, I didn't even notice. And it was like, yeah, that there is elements of it too.
Yeah. And I learned, the other thing I learned from you, and it really has changed how I approach family since you spent time with me last summer, is the whole concept of stigma. I didn't have words around that before. And I didn't really, you know, I would use words that didn't quite get at it, but the concept of stigma and then the concept of community, I could list like five more things I learned from you, but those are some of the most more important things, you know. Oh, and the other one more really important thing is controlling a conversation. I mean, mm-hmm. that's such a useful life skill. And now I have that conversation several times a day about, you know, giving kids sort of, you know, the idea that they can control a conversation if it's about their body. They don't have to, you know, follow what anybody else wants to do or say. They can wrap it up if they're done.
Yeah. They can, and they get to say, so these are the words that I like to describe myself, and, you know, these are words that I like to use, and, like, I don't want to talk about this anymore, and that's okay that they don't, you know, just because they have this thing that's different doesn't mean that they then get to be interrogated by everything. And if they want to talk about it, great. If they don't want to, not great. That was very liberating for me in my own life to come to that realization as well, and that was pretty powerful.
I really love it.
hugely, yes. Dr. James, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us. We just so appreciate having this conversation with you. And of course, we thank you for all the work that you do within our community. You are that conduit, and you have cared for so many of us. So thank you for being that expert, and thank you for being that caretaker to our people. We are very thankful.
It's totally my pleasure. Totally my pleasure and privilege. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you for spending part of your day with us. We want to give thanks to our network, Public House Media, for our intro beats, Jason Barnes with Cybernetics. For our logo art, we want to remember Patrice. You can find his work at normalpersons.com.
Be sure to follow Disarming Disability on Facebook and Instagram. And lastly, be sure to check out our website, disarmingdisability.com, where you can find all 13 episodes of Season 1, links to resources, transcriptions, and discussion questions for each episode.
And check out our blog, where we feature amazing disability advocates.
Bye! Bye.
Virginia, William Hill, America's number one sports book, is now here. And we have a special 2021 offer to help you bet on all your favorite sports risk-free. Download the William Hill Sportsbook app, and when you sign up, you can get started with a risk-free bet of up to $2,021. Use promo code RADIORF.
Terms and conditions apply. 21 plus only. Gambling problem? Call, text, or chat our confidential and toll-free helpline at 1-888-532-3500.
Let's make it interesting with William Hill Sportsbook.
Me, but also you. The Pharaoh fast-forwards his favorite foreign film, Powder Donut. Okay, what's my line?
The only line I see here on the script is get options based on your budget with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive.
Oh, man, that's a tongue twister, huh? I'm sorry, I'm going to need a few more minutes. Bulbous Walrus, the Bulbous Walrus.
The Name Your Price tool, only from Progressive.
The owl ran afoul of the comatose coxswain.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.